Be delighted to answer questions if.
Well, it's a power. If you say that most capable people in the country will be able to work together, you expand that on a huge scale. Do you feel that this is time will change the way we govern ourselves in the United States? Or is how we Congress, how we might vote?
Well, I do think so. I think that, first of all, it means that government will have to earn its way to a much greater extent because the products of the information era are so hard to measure and tax. The government will have to attract and compete to attract the best people into its purview, and that competition will become increasingly intense as time passes. So I think that, but also I think it will make possible for congressmen not to live in Washington. I mean, this is really absurd that congressmen have to spend their entire time in Washington being acclimated to the Washington culture of socialism. And with true teleconferencing, which will increasingly be possible, it will be a congressman will be able to operate much better in his own district than he could back in Washington. And I think there'll be lots of, Ross Perot's idea of sort of an insta-vote, direct democracy is a caricature of the kind of fabric of communication which this technology can indeed offer. Well, you're completely right, and that's why I think, despite the fact that it does not seem to be, strictly speaking, a conservative proposition, nonetheless, term limits is eminently desirable, and since it's widely popular, I think it should be a major focus of political activism for the next decade, really getting term limits. It really would help. It's true that businessmen aren't very good at politics. But it is true that the financing of campaigns is a very important problem. And I think the solution, the real problem, is that rich people are allowed to run themselves, but they aren't allowed to invest in other politicians substantially. And that's, this effort to banish money from politics has resulted in PACs, political action committees, dominating the scene. And a PAC is the very definition of a special interest. I mean, they're rich people of all sorts of descriptions. They live in their communities. They have a variety of interests. But a PAC is a monomaniac. The PAC is interested in one thing. How did you vote on my special interest? And that's why the effort to banish money from politics has been so drastically perverse. It's resulted in nobody but rich people being able to run for the Senate in general. I mean, that's the... And the PACs really being able to buy and sell votes at will.
You've been talking about the information highway. One of the concerns a lot of us have had is the proposals by the government to insist upon what they call the clipper chip data security. And it strikes me that this is one of the most devastating things that the government can do to the advancement of information.
Yeah, I think the clipper chip, this is a requirement that all American electronic equipment contain a government-specified encryption-decryption chip called the clipper chip. And this would indeed be very destructive, not only for the reasons that you mentioned, who wants to buy American electronic goods that contain some this kind of device in it, but also because encryption will be absolutely critical for the next era in electronics, and it's an area of tremendous creativity and development. You know, today, a single CD-ROM can hold 600 big books or several hundred software programs. And nobody could afford to buy one of these CD-ROMs. They cost between 80 cents and $2 to manufacture. But who could afford to buy 600 books or several hundred software programs? They'll only be able to distribute this kind of technology over an information superhighway or anywhere else if it's encrypted. And so we need better encryption tools that allow you, which are emerging in a great flourish of creativity, which allow you to give away a CD-ROM and then charge only for the specific use you make of it. When you decrypt a particular article or item, a tag drops into a memory that's tapped over phone lines and debits your credit card. And so you can be given hundreds of software packages or hundreds of books or whatever, and then pay only for each particular use of it. And this will be tremendous stimulus to the expansion of the industry.
The computers and the efficiencies which come from it as applied to product purchasing seem to benefit consumers. But the entrepreneur is an individual, and generally a small businessman who requires higher profit margins as opposed to maybe the entrepreneur who runs MCI. So how do you see this working out in the long run in terms of home shopping network taking money or our business away from the small store, the Home Depot, which goes an 800 number nationwide, that the small businessman can do? How do you think this is going to come out of the world?
Well, I think for one thing, I mean, this will be the channel, and it won't be necessarily, will not resemble the existing initial and very primitive representations of it. In other words, a home shopping network is a product of the broadcast era rather than the computer era. And it's really just an extension of catalog sales. I mean, it's essentially you're putting catalogs onto the information highway rather than through snail mail or whatever. And I think the catalogs have been an advantage to small businessmen. I mean, there have been just tremendous exploitation of this particular means, and that kind of competition will be extended to the sale of products. And I think, just for one market, today, the broadcast era means that you have 30 channels, maybe, and entrepreneurs promise 500 channels, and this is the choice that will be rendered by the information highway, so to speak. But I don't think that that indeed captures the change that's underway. What's going to happen is the video business will resemble more closely the book business. And rather than having 30 channels or 500 channels, you'll have the kind of creativity that you now see in the book and magazine business. There are 55,000 trade books published in the United States every year. There are scores of thousands of magazines and newsletters. It's an efflorescence of entrepreneurial creativity in the text business today. And what I see is that kind of proliferation of choice that you see in text being extended to video and movies and all these other areas. And I think that is going to happen. And I think it also will greatly improve the quality of the culture. You know, half the book business, most of the book business is either technical or career or serious books of various kinds. Half of it is religious books. It really does not resemble at all the current video business as you see in broadcast TV in Hollywood.
With the CD-ROM and network technology, won't there evolve eventually what you might call a virtual voucher where parents can educate their children?
Oh, yeah.
Get networks at home with CD-ROM and completely bypass the public school system?
I'm doing it today. That's what I do. It seems to me that when you can summon into your living room the best teachers on the face of the earth to teach your kids at the pace they need, it becomes less inviting to send them out to stand beside the road in the snow waiting for some bus to take them to some school where they open the day by putting a condom on a banana, which is actually what happens in New York City. They actually practice in these co-ed groups putting condoms on bananas. Have they introduced that to San Francisco yet? It should be popular here, right?
How do you see the importance of the communication network introduced to the workplace, the products of the selling of products is one thing, but the production of products is where your jobs originate. And how do you see the benefits of this communication network improving quality of jobs, quality of products, and overall consumption of products, which is really what you have to do in order to create more jobs?
Yeah. Well, I think the crux of it is that computer networks eliminate middlemen. That's essentially what they do. They allow people to contract directly with others for the production of goods and services and their delivery. And that means more people devoted directly to the productive activities that remain. It is by making workers productive that you make them employable. You know, and that's what technology does. You link technology to a worker and you make him more productive and thus more employable. This whole idea that employers hire people because they're cheap is completely wrong. Employers hire people because they produce more than they cost. And by this spread of technology, you enhance the productivity and thus the employability of the workforce. And I also think these kinds of technologies, particularly in the educational side, will overcome many of the problems of our schools and thus make lifelong learning tied to specific productive responsibilities more feasible and more successful. So I think that there's always been the fear that any new technology will displace workers, and it's just a false fear. It's always been a false fear because new technologies generate the wealth that endows workers to perform new tasks. The investment itself, by creating wealth, supplies the antidote to the job displacement. It makes workers more productive and thus more employable is the essence of it.
What do you think about intellectual property? You talked about the importance of property, and you talked about how increasingly wealth is compounding the mind. Yeah. What is the role of intellectual property going to play in the future? How is it going to be protected?
Well, I'm very interested in intellectual property, since that's all I got. And I think that that one of the ways it will be protected is through encryption of the. I mean, today I write an article, and that's the end of it. You know, it doesn't matter whether everybody in the country reads it or whether three people read it. I still get compensated the same way. And this is a terribly inefficient way of compensating the holders of intellectual property. And I think that this encryption scheme that I described, whereby you can put hundreds, even eventually thousands of books on a single read-only memory and encrypt all these articles and have abstracts that you can read and all sorts of computer search technologies, and charge people for each time they read one of these articles, each time they decrypt it. You don't charge them much. You don't have to charge them. If you charge them anything at all, you hugely increase the flow of income to the authors over what the current flow is. They estimated it, you know, currently Gary Trudeau makes something like $25 for every newspaper that carries his column for his cartoons for a week. I can't remember what it is, some amazingly small amount of money. But if you just had all the people who wanted to read Gary Trudeau or have it pay a couple cents, Trudeau would make thousands of dollars a week per paper, and it's just that kind of advantage to holders of intellectual property. There are lots of issues of intellectual property, including software patents and a whole array of very tangled issues that I won't address now. But it is going to be a central issue for the next era.
Now, the guy that was on PBS this morning before you was a researcher. University of these things, Rhodes, and he studies, he has a laboratory that does Alzheimer's research, and that was the very problem he was explaining about, is the fact that the research that they've done, now when he goes to a medical convention, he shares the information, and other people are able to replicate his experiments immediately, and he no longer has privacy. Now he's playing his cards very close to his chest. How does this encourage more interplay between
people
who are studying the same problem?
Well, it can, and it particularly if you can actually enforce the rights to some degree. But it's true that this is information is different from other products. You give it to somebody else, and you also keep it. I mean, it's a different. You both have it, and it's just not clear that very ruthless defense of property rights actually yields the most success. I mean, who would have believed that in the early 80s, when WordStar and a number of other word processing programs completely dominated the field, they were very efficient, they were advancing readily, and yet 3 years later, this new company from Orem, Utah, called WordPerfect, completely dominated the scene. It took about 2 or 3 years, and suddenly they were completely dominant. They did not have a decidedly better product. All they did was say, please steal my program. Please copy WordPerfect. Give it to all your employees. Please spread it as widely as possible. As a result, everybody bought WordPerfect, but they bought it, and they used it. They could copy it when they needed to, but they also needed the services and and maintenance of the program. So I think it's not clear that that sort of complete secrecy and kind of hoarding of your intellectual property is the most successful strategy. So, but at the same time, I do think that you know, there will be new ways of gaining income from intellectual property developed over the years, and I think that they will be beneficial. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, George. Again, we hope that everyone here will pick up copies of George's books, Wealth and Poverty, and also Recapturing the Spirit of Enterprise. And I believe that we might even interest him, as I said before, in signing a copy. So thank you so much for coming and joining with us, and we hope that we'll see you again at a future independent policy forum.